Well, welcome everybody to this. I think we're up to our fourth Labour Housing Group in conversation with events. My name's Rachel Blake. I'm a member of the Labour Housing Group Executive, and we work as a team to bring you these events and these discussions with leading thinkers on housing issues at the moment. We're really grateful to have Danny Dorling with us. I can't remember when I first discovered Danny Dorling's work about inequality, but he certainly is described as a data rummager, I think, which sounds like a lot of fun to me. And he's going to be talking to us about Fintopia and happiness, I think, this evening. So Danny, we're a group of people who care particularly about housing, and I'm sure you'll have all already discovered the impact that housing has on happiness and inequality. So I will hand over to you. You're welcome to speak for as long as you like. And then we would like to ask you some questions. So if you could leave a little bit of time for that as well. We're aiming to finish at about 7. Over to you, Danny.
Okay, I'm not planning to speak for very long, maybe 15 minutes, because I find it much more interesting to do questions and answers. And the longer this pandemic goes on, the more and more I find it interesting to do questions and answers. Although it's very nice to be able to see you all, because with students, we often can't see them. And we just talk to ourselves at a screen for hour after hour. Anyway, you're interested in housing. Fintopia, I've got copies here, it's a book all about Finland, looks like that. Happy children ice skating on the front cover. You automatically think of Finland as cold, which it is in winter, but it isn't in summer. Remarkably well-housed place, essentially. Famous for the policy on homelessness. What people may not know is that there were 20, 30 years ago, tens of thousands of people who were homeless in Finland, particularly Helsinki. So it was an issue they had, and they had to solve, and they solved it with a mechanism that we now call Housing First, but it was very practical. It was the idea that you simply decide you're not going to tolerate street homelessness, and you're not going to ask questions, you're going to house people first and then deal with their other problems. The reason I wrote a book on Finland with my co-author Nika Kalogian, who is Finnish, which is essential if you can't read Finnish. You don't write a book on Finland if you can't. Was because it is particularly remarkable in Europe as a country, because it doesn't have excess money. It is not particularly rich, but it has managed to solve many problems, including many housing problems. If you talk to Finns, they will automatically tell you about their problems and how expensive housing is and so on. So it's just when you compare Finland to other countries. Of course, it's a spectrum. The other Nordic countries are pretty good. Germany's pretty good. The Netherlands isn't bad. But the nice thing for us about Finland is it shows what's possible when you don't have very much money. And we are not going to have very much money, no matter how... What particular monetary theory you might believe, or how much you think can be printed. England in particular is going to have to sort itself out without the advantage that it had in the past, which was riches. I think it's George Orwell who said soon after the Second World War that the British people didn't really understand that they could have a welfare state because they still had the tail end of an empire. When we were building those huge numbers of decent council houses, you know, the three bed semis and so on with the big gardens, we were partly doing that off the back of the tail end of money that we were making from India and series of countries in Africa and so on. Finland has had to sort out its problems without colonies. In fact, Finland famously was a colony. It's a colony of Russia, a colony of Sweden, amongst others. And it's a particularly pragmatic Finnish attitude to things that has got Finland through. I won't go on too much about Finland, but the point is you can't suddenly make yourself Finland. This is of more interest to people in Scotland for obvious reasons than it is for you, because lots of people in Scotland have ideas about what they could suddenly do if they were suddenly allowed to do it. And the point of writing the book Fintopia was partly to try to show that it's taken generations to achieve what they've achieved in Finland, but it is entirely possible to do so. And the other point of it was to say that you cannot just solve one problem on its own. If you look around the world, so my only claim to ability is a geographer. I'm a geographer, so I look at data and look at data for different countries. And if you look around the world, you don't find a country that has solved its housing problems but not other problems, or solved its health problems but not other problems, or solved its education problems but not other problems. And this is the point of a Labour Party. You know, if you want the reason, if you're sometimes feeling, why on earth am I involved in the political party? Why am I not involved in a pressure group or something else? I can't stand this anymore. I have to go to these bloody meetings. Actually, knowing that if you don't do it all at once or all in concert, it doesn't work. Not saying that pressure groups aren't useful, but it's just a coincidence of seeing, you know, why did the Finns manage to create a system in which they house each other, in which they don't have to see people in the gutter and so on? It might also be related to the fact that your average Finnish teenager can speak three languages or four languages, or if they go to university, six languages. And the fact that they've got income inequality is really low, so they don't see other people as beneath them, which in a country where some people are much highly paid than others, they do. Well, why does housing matter to the Finns? Well, it's because they've solved other problems. A few years ago, they had the lowest infant mortality rate in the world. You know, and okay, you can do better than the lowest infant mortality rate in the world, but not much better. I think it was less than 100 babies died in 1 year. You know, so you then move on to wanting to solve other things. And I'll stop at Finland at this, but, you know, it could give you hope. If people say, oh, that isn't possible, it is very useful to have somewhere in Europe that actually is doing it. You know, it just patently is possible. It's just a choice, but it's not necessarily easy. Let me turn to Britain now to try and provoke you on housing. Housing is key to Britain. This is the point I'm going to try something I haven't done before at all. This may not work. You know, when you share your screen, well, I'm going to try and do it by holding up a graph to the camera. Right. There we go. Okay, sorry. I just think it's more reliable. This is a little graph of voting at the 2019 general election. And it divides the country into 66 squares because there were 66 million people.
Annie, can you move it up a bit or down a bit? Yeah, that down, stop.
Down, okay.
Up, right. Stop.
Okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Now, there are six columns and there are 11 rows, 11 times 6 is 66. Each row has people of a certain age. At the top are children who don't get to vote. And then you get the teenagers and young adults and so on. And my point of showing it, and you may well know, but Labour squares, Labour has 10 squares, 10 million voters, all squeezed on one side. Quite a wide range of ages of people vote Labour. The Tories are all the blue squares. And they've got 14 million of them, 14 squares. And they're all bunched down below age 43. To get a million Tory voters, you've got to go down, I think it's to age 43. I can't see that side of the graph. We won't worry about the other parties in the middle and so on, or people who didn't get a vote because they're EU but not UK citizens. That's all the detail. The key thing is the massive cleavage now in voting is age. And I'll put this away now. Why is it age? It's much safer than sharing a screen. You might never get it back again if you do that. Why it is age, I think, is housing. The Tory trick, and it's been a Tory trick since the 1980s, is you tell people, work hard, strive, you can get your house. Or, you know, if you work really hard, you could get two or three houses. And we will make sure your house maintains its value. That's what we'll do. Quietly as a party, we'll make sure house prices don't fall. And we'll certainly make sure that nobody threatens to tax your wealth on it or anything. And that'll be your future. That'll be your safety net. That'll be your pension. That'll help your children. That'll be everything for you. And it's a brilliant con because it's all about the future. You can't realize it now. You know, you can't turn it into a pension now. You can't house your children using this house now. But don't you worry, if you live in Oxford, that three-bedroom semi might be worth £550,000. That's a fortune. You know, all you've got to do is move a couple of hundred miles and sell it, and you'll be absolutely okay. Just don't vote for those dangerous left-wingers who want to take what you've worked hard for away. And the reason why I think increasingly that this is so important, it's just a strengthening of this pattern over time. There was a lovely graphic in 1993. If anybody can remember negative equity, 1989-1991, the Conservatives lost control of the outer boroughs of London. And the map was called the Incredible Shrinking Tories. And what happened is that Conservative voters, when their houses fell in price in the early 90s, didn't bother to vote. They didn't vote Labour. Bit like the last election, Labour lost because 2 million Labour voters didn't vote. But when Conservatives see their house prices fall, they stop voting Conservative and sulk. They might vote Liberal. What has the government done since 2010? The coalition government and then the Conservative government since 2015. They've maintained house prices. They spent an absolute fortune on it. Help to buy. 40% discounts in London, 40% protected by government, so the banks weren't even taking the risk. All of that was to hold house prices up. And I sometimes feel a bit stupid on this, in that a senior civil servant once told me, when I was doing a talk for the civil service about housing affordability, just came up and said, "You do know we're trying to keep house prices up." And I went, "Why are you trying to keep house prices up?" And he went, "Well, it's one of our indicators of economic success. If London in particular is a high house price city, that means it's doing well economically. It means that people are being paid a lot of money in London. They can afford to buy the houses or pay the rent. There's no problem with high house prices. It's just actually a sign of success." But we don't tell everybody that because it makes them a bit upset sometimes. But we have no intention of trying to reduce the rent or reduce the house prices. It goes against our beliefs about what is good economically. So, you know, that's sort of what I've come to believe over 20 years, and it's changed what I believe. The situation now is really interesting. The data is incredibly unreliable. The housing industry is chucking out report after report saying we're still in some kind of housing boom. ONS, because they had to deal with the pandemic, took unprecedented steps of not releasing their house price data since February and only releasing it very, very slowly because the number of transactions was too low. And they said it didn't represent a fair view of the market. So I'll get on to talk about renting in a minute. I will be quick on this. We know that people who can are trying to leave London, who are not forced to be there. I'm in Oxford at the moment. There are very few sold signs, I'll just put it like that. But a lot of people with vested interest in the market who want to say it's still healthy, house prices haven't fallen, but I don't see a huge amount of evidence for them not falling. Tragically, of course, roughly 50,000 people, mainly very old, have died, more than would normally die. Roughly half of those people lived on their own, and most of them, because of their age, own their house. So that's a large number of properties that have gone on the market this year, and it's hardly a sign of confidence in the housing market, and you try to sell them. So those kind of things are happening. Renting. You all know about the shenanigans about trying to avoid getting families evicted in front of the cameras, which is why the emergency orders not allowing landlords to evict at first and then kind of pressurise and so on were put in. And I almost lose track of where we are. It's kind of pushed forward and forward just to try and ramp up how fearful tenants are that, you know, next week they might be evicted is the kind of game they're playing. The emergency legislation on it, interestingly, I had a copy of it. It doesn't cover you if you're involved in riot. which shows how scared the government were at the time they're putting the emergency legislation to do with COVID through. They assumed that there were going to be mass riots, or assumed it enough to sort of think that it would help. It's ridiculous what they think. Do they think that private tenants read statutory instruments to see if the word riot is there before deciding to go on a riot? Anyway, that's the government we've got. We're looking at mass evictions. We're looking at mass unemployment. We are about to absolutely destroy the economy of Liverpool, of Manchester, of what was left of the middle of these cities. So it's going to, you know, that is on the cards. The rise in destitution is on the cards. Government are trying to treat the homeless as they treated them before. They allowed them into hotels, reopen the hostels, stop worrying about homeless people on the streets. The reason for the rapid housing of the homeless was pure fear from the upper classes that homeless people might spread COVID to them. Otherwise, they wouldn't have bothered housing the homeless. That's why they did it. If they actually cared, they wouldn't be chucking them out again now. So to wrap up, we're in an unprecedented situation. Housing is the major form in which wealth is held in this country. The second major form is pensions. They're not doing particularly well, private pensions. The sentiment on which the housing market is based is rocky. I haven't mentioned Brexit, and I won't again unless you want to, but it almost certainly doesn't help your housing market if you try to really, really put off 500 million people who live very near you from coming over and renting your property. Let's put it that way. It's a disaster that we are currently in. That is not necessarily bad news, because the disaster isn't that we've had an earthquake and the property has fallen down. Although in many parts of Britain with lockdowns, if property is abandoned, it doesn't take very many months of property being abandoned, and say businesses, for it to become harder to open it up again. It's tricky for Labour to know what to do with the distance they have to an election. What do you say now? What do you say later? I think there will be a long-term effect of the pandemic in terms of its scarred people. And there will be a long-term effect over how come you had two houses or three houses? How come you could go to Cornwall if you wanted to, if you know about the number of people who did do that? Isn't it about time you actually choose which one of your properties you'd actually like to have? And do you really need the other ones? I think these things become a little bit easier to say, given what people have lived through, given how cramped they've been in particular circumstances. So there's a lot that can be done. There's playing a game politically, which is always hard. So a note of caution to end on. This government have managed to get a majority of people in Britain in recent weeks to blame each other for the pandemic and not the government for its level. Opinion polls are showing that. And it's not hard, because you can see the person not wearing their mask, and you can imagine the university students having a party, whereas actually knowing what happens in a SAGE meeting is rather more difficult. And it's tricky for Labour what they say immediately about housing. The last Labour administration, Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell, and the housing ministry, shadow housing minister John Healey, is probably the longest lasting shadow minister in the same post. Brilliant. Actually get to know what he's doing. But one thing they did, which may have been a mistake, but it only affected my hometown, and Tim's here who knows it well. They did announce, I think in 2017, that they were in favour of the compulsory purchase of land on the edge of cities at agricultural prices, which is great and very laudable, but I wish they just hadn't said it. Because the problem is that when they said it, what happened in my hometown of Oxford is that several of the colleges which owned this land immediately tried to sell it to developers to build large detached houses for London commuters on it, because they suddenly saw that a Labour victory was a clear and present danger to 300 years of property ownership that they'd had. So the last thing I'll say is, you don't necessarily say what you're going to do, either if it won't actually help you win votes, or if it might result in the very opposite to what you want, which in the case of my home city is, unless COVID intervenes and helps, houses costing £1 million or £2 million on the edge of a city in which almost no nurses can afford to live. I hope that's been of some use. I really do hope you've got questions. That is about 20 minutes, so that's long enough of me talking at you. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Danny. That's absolutely brilliant. And I think I've learnt as much about politics as I have about geography and data, and certainly a reminder about keep on going with the Labour Party meetings. And also I think the really interesting point that you make about knowing what we need to do, but not sure whether it's electable. And I think maybe the Green Belt might come into that if somebody wants to ask a question about that. So I will ask if Jane wants to unmute and put her question. Jane Corbett.
So Danny, I'm up in Liverpool. I put a nice easy question for you. If you were Prime Minister for a year and you'd got in with a good majority, what would you do for that year? So it basically goes back to your question about you can't only do one thing at a time. But anyway, go on.
Okay.
How the future could really look if we were in.
That'd be different. I'd repeal short-hold tenancies, that Margaret Thatcher Act, that means you can be kicked out with 2 months' notice and so on. And that's a very quick one to do and replace it. Well, hopefully you'd have spent some time beforehand to decide carefully what your replacement would be. But we have enough different examples from enough countries in Europe, and can have huge arguments about them. But the fundamental thing is they're almost all better just in terms of human rights and the fact this is a home to ours. So that would be the first one. The second one would be replacing council tax with something more progressive. Doesn't have to be perfect. And again, I'm very much not into not has to be perfect, because what we often do on the left is endless arguments about utopia. And, you know, and I'm all in favor of land value taxes. But to be honest, adding council tax bans, MNOPQRS, like little cat Z, if you know your Dr. Seuss, so that somebody who's got a mansion worth 50 million is on council tax ban Z, you know, I think it'd be highly popular and people would understand that. Whereas if you say we'll have a wealth tax on property, which is the same rate as the Irish rate, which is 0.08%, hardly anybody knows what 0.08% or whatever is. I may have got that wrong by a factor of 10, it doesn't matter. But anyway, explain that council tax is extremely unfair and replace it with something fairer. Those are the two immediate things. And they're partly because solving the thing that most people are more worried about, which is street homelessness, as soon as they don't worry about themselves, it is solved by not having a housing system which is so terrible that in the case of London or Oxford, pretty rich students end up renting somewhere that was pretty dire. And so it's not available to people whose lives are often falling apart and who'd normally live in that place. So you have to solve the problem across the board. The decent taxation on housing is the encouragement not to own two or three properties, unless you really want to and you love paying tax. In which case, you know, if somebody has a fetish and likes having an empty six-bedroom house that's spare to them, let them do it. Just have a very high wealth tax that's even higher if you don't have to ever occupy that home that you're in.
That all sounds good to me. I'm sure we'll all go away thinking about what we would do as well. So thanks for that brilliant question, Jane. I'm going to take Robert's question and Tim Lund's question together because I think they're both particularly about Finnish local authorities or Finnish arrangements. So I'll take Robert and then Tim together, please. So Robert, do you want to come in? And Robert Sale?
Thanks. Yes, I didn't realise that. You were talking about me. Yeah, what I was interested to know about was the private rented sector in Finland. So capped rents, security of tenure like they do in Germany for life, and possibly it's illegal to evict tenants during the winter. Is that what they do?
Thanks, Robert. Danny, can I just ask Tim Lund to come in as well? Because then it's just a general thing about local government as well. So, Tim?
Okay, you can hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Kind of spookily, I have a nephew who's married to a Finn who actually now lives in Utrecht. And a few months ago, I had a very interesting Zoom with them talking about how her engagement with local planning in Utrecht worked and why democracy in Holland seems to be much more functional than ours. So, you know, this is a background to my kind of sometimes obsessive interest in how local governments work and the relationship between them and central government. So that's why when you say things are great in Finland, my first question is it a function to do with how local government works and its relationship with the centre? Does local government decide effectively what gets built?
Okay, on both of those, I'm not a complete expert on everything Finnish, which is partly why I wrote the book with a Finn. I think the key thing about the private sector in Finland is it's relatively small. So you can choose whether to be in it or not much more, as well as having controls. But there is a lot of state housing, and the state housing is almost indistinguishable. You'll know if you've ever been to Finland that the housing all looks fairly indistinguishable from each other, but that's because that's the kind of housing you build for a cold winter. It's the insides that are nice, not the outsides. It's more a country like England where the outside really matters, particularly how shiny the doorstep is, but you don't tell people how bad the inside is. So the private sector is controlled and you're not allowed to behave in very bad ways in Finland. I think it changes in the middle of Helsinki, where it can get quite very expensive. Local authorities have dramatically more control in Finland to such an extent, and there are so many of them, and some of them are so small, that it actually causes a problem, particularly with health services and inefficiency. So they're constantly talking about how to get local authorities to work together because they're tiny. A very small municipality can have enormous power, but doesn't actually contain enough people to, in effect, do your civil service that'll do the work. But it's just a basic level of decency. This is a much more fundamental thing to the rules and the law, is that you wouldn't treat people like this, even if you're allowed to. And if you did, the reaction of other people to you behaving in that way is to see you as a pariah and so on. So that's there. Whereas we have the opposite. We've whittled our local government down to often just a few hundred people actually being employed, of which one of the largest group are the people who collect the bins, unless that's been thrown out to a privatised company. And we just have this kind of skeletal local government left with, you know, elected officials who have tiny powers to do things, can put in cycle lanes and so on and that kind of thing. But even when they try to do something innovative with housing and come to a deal where a certain amount of housing is built not for profit and the others for profit, they find themselves usurped by private developers and their power is very low. So it's kind of like it's chalk and cheese. And it'll take time to get towards that better position. You don't get it overnight. And this is, I think, one tricky thing for left-wing politics is trying to explain to people that it is not about immediately giving you jam in the next 5 years. It is about not being as awful as those other people and making things better each year than they were the year before. But you cannot suddenly, you can suddenly change the law on certain things. But what you really have to win are hearts and minds to take a generation to change. And in this country, being the opposite to Finland, England is the most unequal in Europe. Thatcher won. She said, the real goal is the hearts and minds. We need to make people individualistic, selfish, caring about themselves. The power of that will be enormous. And so that's a huge thing to begin to try to reverse. You're trying to give a sort of sense of responsibility and sharing into a generation whose parents had it ripped out of them. But don't want to be bleak about it, but that's the trickiness of the situation we're in. And the myth of, get yourself on the housing ladder, that will sort you out, is incredibly powerful. It's what people hold on to now. If you get yourself a basic job in your 20s, you save and save and save for 20 years and you meet the right person, they've done that. And you never know, you might just manage to get a house in your 40s and you might just finish off paying a mortgage when you're 67. And that's actually seen as a dream. That's the English dream. And it's ridiculous. But because that's the only thing people have got, you're having to work against that. Just give you one more example from Norway of the differences between our countries. Primary school children in Norway, in their first term at school, go to see their friends' bedrooms. So the whole class goes out and they take a walk around the neighbourhood and they knock on the door. They don't tell the parents because the parents know this happens. And the whole class goes to see where so-and-so sleeps and so on. Then they do it again and again that day. And they only know this because an English couple living in Norway was shocked one day when their child knocked on the door and the whole class was there. And it's just to check out that everybody's bedroom is okay and they're all being housed all right. Now, can you imagine in a primary school in England, the teacher and the children going around to check where everybody lives and what kind of bedroom they've got and what kind of house they live in. And because we've internalized the kind of shame and space and don't complain, it just wouldn't happen. So I'm trying to give you a sort of sense of proportion and time. It takes a generation to actually get what they've got. And it's dangerous to think you can have it immediately. It doesn't mean you shouldn't strive for it, but perfectly right. But there's a danger first of all, people saying that's impossible and you're not getting into power. But secondly, getting into power and disappointing. Whereas if you say, yes, it's hard work and it'll take longer, it's harder for people to criticise you for suggesting something that's impossible. If you say the first 2 years will be tough, the next years will be tough, but after 5 years, it'll be better than the beginning. And it's also easier to keep going without being massively disappointed because the New Jerusalem has not been built. I think that kind of realism is needed. And I very much like the Labour Party of 2015 to 2019. But there was a kind of lack of realism of what would actually happen in a short amount of time. And how you look back on it and it's great, but at the time of inequalities falling, it often doesn't feel great. The biggest fall in inequalities in this country occurred in the 1920s and 1930s. Miners' strike in 1921, general strike in 26. 1930s mass unemployment. All the time, the gap between rich and poor was falling. All the time, the number of people who were servants was falling. All the time, the value of the big country houses was falling. And then the wars. All the time, we were becoming more equal. But it didn't feel, falls in inequality are not actually often associated with joyous happiness. They're associated with the rich seeing that their wealth falling faster and the poor going on strike and scrabbling to keep what they've got. And during those circumstances, the gap comes together. But it's not pressing a button and everything is okay. Sorry, I promised a shorter answer next.
Thanks, Danny. And there's a question here about something a bit more optimistic. So I'll give you a bit of a time to think about that as well. But I've got Sheila and Andy wanted to ask a bit more detail about Finland. So Sheila, will you come in?
Yes, we had a fringe meeting at Labour Party conference, the Connected conference a few weeks ago about housing as a right, and if it was a human right in this country, it would be a big step in the path of ending homelessness. And I wondered if Finland has adopted that concept of housing as a human right, and if not, are they working on it? And should we do it here?
And Andy?
Yeah, thanks, Rachel. I wanted to ask about the size of public housing and particularly cooperative housing in Finland.
Okay. I don't think they've enshrined it as a human right. In fact, Finland is somewhat behind in terms of human rights. So when Anika and me were writing this book, Fintopia, we tried to concentrate on what was not good in Finland, what wasn't working, because it's easy to write, you know, Finland ranks first, second or third on over 100 social statistics. And one of the complaints of things, well, they've got a fascist party, admittedly one of Europe's cuddliest fascist parties, but I didn't say that, but, you know, for the free Finns are not nice, but don't win. In terms of human rights, Finland is slightly slow on rights to be who you want, rights of identity, ability to change sex and so on. We have a section of that in the book. So the housing thing wasn't done through saying you have a right and it has to happen. It was actually a very pragmatic man. I've lost, okay, it's not a tiny country, it's not big. I've forgotten his name, very pragmatic man, and a group of people who decided they were going to do this and got the government to fund them to actually sort out the housing first. And I wish I could remember his name, but perhaps it's good I can't, because he came over to England and he actually phoned me up because he heard us writing this book and came to my office. And the reason he'd been over to England was he'd been invited to a meeting in the Thames Valley of local authorities interested in housing first and how to solve it, Labour wants. And he just said to me, he said, you've got decades to go. You don't understand. You just have to do it. You just have to decide you're going to do it and do it. And there's this kind of practical nature to Finnish people of, if you are going to get grants from the government to help you do something, you don't waste the money from that. Particularly if you were to waste the money, you would have problems actually housing the last few people you're going to house. Housing statistics are unbelievable. They know to the nearest person how many teenagers are homeless. When they say 16 homeless teenagers, they mean 16. When they say 37 others, the difference between our rough sleep account and who you can be bothered to do and this kind of meticulous thing is incredible. Sorry, that was a question about rights. What was the other question?
It's about public housing and cooperative housing.
I don't know about the cooperative housing. I'm sure it happens. The public housing is large, but more importantly, doesn't look any different and is mixed up. And there's lots of concern whenever it looks as if there's going to be an area with more concentration of private housing than public, they worry. And partly because schools. They have the best schooling system on the planet, true comprehensive schools with the best results on the planet. I mean, unbelievable. Writing a book with somebody who's about 22, who has better English than me, better maths than me, and speaks 8 languages, you know, it's ridiculous. And here's the thing about the housing. If you do have the best system of comprehensive schooling in the world, with less than 1% not using your comprehensive schools, and all the schools are incredibly good, so the parents don't have to worry about what school their child goes to, you really, really worry about somebody building a set of social housing in one area with no private housing, because that'll muck up your school system. They have worries about, they've had a lot of refugees recently, and they have worries about racism and people trying to avoid the areas where the Somali refugees are. Now those areas will be where there is more social housing. And so that their policy on housing is intricately linked to the success of the education system. Because you can't have a good education system if you have a divided housing system. And it works. And this isn't, what's really funny is, you know, it's that they're not a sort of set of believers like you. There were sets of people like you in the 60s and 70s in Finland who argued for this and got it going. They're doing this just because it's sensible. It's cheap, it's effective. You know, the best way to get a good education system is a comprehensive education system where every school's good. You get a far better education that way than any other way. It's not an idealistic thing, it's not morals, it's just better. So they've slowly discovered a way that is better. And it isn't led, interestingly, by, so it's not evangelical. Finns do not go around the world saying, you should be like us, we're great, why didn't you adopt, you know, they just don't do that. They do worry about the things that don't work. There probably is somebody Finnish watching, of the people who got their cameras turned off, and they're probably sitting there going, God, he doesn't know how bad it is, you know, and I left, and, you know, the issue about gambling or drinking or whatever. Incredibly introspective. And looking for things going wrong, and careful. Finland has been stockpiling PPE, which you now know what PPE is, since 1957, which was not even the last big flu pandemic. But they stockpiled it because you might need it, because it's sensible. Why would you not stockpile PPE? Because of course a pandemic's going to happen. Now, you know, that might get a bit grating for some people, that degree of preparedness and, you know, sensibleness and so on. But it does sort things out. And it, you know, I think we do need to begin to say other places have done this. Sorry, last thing to say on this Finnish comparison. The reason why we don't make this comparison is because you've only got to go back to the 60s and the Finns were dirt poor. And we were unbelievably rich. And you may have forgotten, if you're that, many of you aren't the right age, but if you ever went abroad in the 1960s to France or Germany, we lived like kings, you know. So this is a relatively recent turnaround. And it's also a bit hard for some people to take that we squandered our oil wealth, we squandered the last of the empire. We have fallen down so far. And meanwhile, somewhere with all the disadvantages in the world, on the edge of Russia during the middle of the Cold War, without great oil reserves like Norway or anything else, has quietly achieved this. So, you know, there's a patriotism problem with selling this, and you do have to explain it's patriotic to want to have a better country with less poverty and better housing systems and so on, I think.
Thank you, Danny. We've got Peter Moss, and then I'm going to ask Peter Moss and then Dermot McKibben to come in. Peter?
Hi, yes. Thanks, Danny. Peter Moss, Deputy Leader at Preston City Council. Really grateful for your time this evening. It was probably a much of a tongue-in-cheek question as much as anything, but I just wondered really, in terms of housing in the UK, is there anything positive we can latch on to in terms of a good news story? Thank you.
And then Dermot.
Danny, does Finland have a universal basic income system, and how does it work, and how relevant is it to the UK?
Okay, I'll do that one first because that's easier. Finland's been at the head of the world in experiments in universal basic income. Whole series of experiments of applying it to see if it works or not. Like I say, they're not idealistic. If it doesn't work, they won't do it. But they try it. The most recent one does suggest that it is worthwhile. The outcomes are worth the amount it costs. It's an expensive thing to do, But people don't become work shy. They're more effective if they can choose what work they do, and they don't have to work if they don't want to. But importantly, Finland is one of a very large number of countries that are doing experiments in universal basic income. So, you know, it looks like they will expand and expand it in a series of trials to get bigger and bigger. And as long as it works, that is where they'll head to. These things are all relatively recent. The word unemployment, I think, only entered the Oxford English Dictionary in something like 1888. Before then, you couldn't be unemployed. You know, you're just lazy or starving. But, you know, the actual idea of unemployment is a recent one. So, you know, I see universal basic income as simply a continuation of that. And I guess it, the Nordic countries have done pretty well in the pandemic because of their better social security systems. The Finns, I don't know, maybe, you know, they can be a bit over. Only 320 people have died in this pandemic in Finland. And I was supposed to be going to a conference in June next year, which has been cancelled because of the pandemic, which you might think is slightly too much, you know, worrying. But anyway, you can see the difference. Good housing stories in Britain. We do have, historically, we have an incredible housing story, which is the social housing story in the welfare state in the 40s. As an academic called Nancy Kwok, who's written a brilliant World History of Housing, who said that the Americans saw this as the very worst thing in the world, the British social housing system, and were worried that it would take off and be copied around the planet, and spent a fortune in the 50s and 60s and 70s propping up secretly the private housing sector of countries to stop them mimicking the British social housing model. So you shouldn't underestimate just how good that was. The 1946 birth cohort study, which is a random study, we have these random studies of children. The majority of children in the 1946 study lived at some point in a council house. So if you know anybody born in the 1940s, and actually even in the 1950s, and they say to you, sorry if this upsets any of you, they go, oh, I was brought up in a council house. Just say to them, you were normal. You were normal. Most people were at one point, not always throughout the child, but at one point. So we had a system that worked dramatically well, was extremely fast transition from 90% private renting before the Second World War. To decent homes for many. And that is worth remembering because other places didn't do it. And that's the thing I would hold on to. The other really important thing is that say, what's good about our system? Well, quite a lot of the greed resulted in quite a lot of housing being built. So we actually have more flats, apartments and houses per person than ever. We have more bedrooms per person than ever. In London, there's more than one bedroom for everybody living in London. So if nobody wanted to share a bed with anybody else, there's actually enough housing there. So and of course, the overseas investments, not to Preston, but the southern parts of the country, to Manchester, have resulted in the building of more housing. The problem is that so many of the apartments are empty. So many of this, but it's there. You know, so it's you know, that is useful. But I'm afraid since the early 80s, our record hasn't been good. What New Labour did under Blair was put in an enormous amount of double glazing, huge improvement to social housing, which had been allowed to get to a terrible state, boilers and so on. But they were ashamed of it. They didn't say they were doing it because they worried they'd lose votes if they said publicly that they were doing this. And it wasn't a transformative thing. It was just patching up what Margaret Thatcher allowed to get worse. So we do need a transformative thing. What I'd love to see in my lifetime, and this exists in various forms, it exists in Sheffield, is I'd love to see the right to sell. And this is the right where, rather than hand the keys to the building society or bank when you can't pay the mortgage, you make a request to your local authority, and they, at a discount, they buy the share off the bank, who have no choice, and you become a tenant. And then you stay in your home, and your children still go to the same school. And as far as you're concerned, nothing happens. You can't change the boiler quite as easily by yourself. But when you leave, that's now public ownership housing. And this would destroy 100% private sector enclaves. And the idea that housing prices, how far away are you from a council estate? All that idea in Britain. So that's the kind of thing that an innovative government could bring in. And the Conservatives can't, it's interesting what the Conservatives can and can't do. They'll do almost everything to stay in power and win elections. But there are some things they're fundamentally opposed to. And that is one where Labour can outsource them. And it's a nice policy. It's a policy all about people not being thrown out. And because the only people who lose out are banks, you know, nobody sheds a tear over banks, do they? So I'd like to see us do that. Yes,
thanks.
So I just think Martha said mortgage rescue schemes. Yes, that's it. So,
yeah, I was just going to say, Danny, it's not far off a mortgage rescue scheme and the ones that they were operating in 2010 to 12. So, there are some options around that. And also, I'm Deputy Mayor in Tower Hamlets. I think there's some other local councillors here. We will buy back properties, but then let them as social housing. But then obviously they are subject to the right to buy if people move in with the tenancies. But I think that right to sell is really quite compelling, really. Any final questions? Can you indicate in the chat or wave? Or just unmute yourself, and then Danny can have some closing. Oh, Jill, did you want to make your observation about Russia? Unmute, Jill.
Yeah. I just wondered, Danny, because I have been to Finland, and it seems to me that part of the issue in Finland is they're next to Russia. They were a colony themselves. And pragmatically, they know they knew for years they couldn't push the Russians too far. So they don't have, so they're very pragmatic and they don't have that imperial hangover. So it's kind of cultural, isn't it? That, I mean, and the Tories like exploit the imperial hangover in Britain and especially in England. And I kind of don't know, but it seems to me that that's part of the problem, that it's a cultural issue about how the Tories exploit that and get people thinking they should still be a powerful country and we should have a big army and, you know, worry about our position in the world. And the Finns don't worry about anything like that because they couldn't.
No. And this is another way we shouldn't beat ourselves up about things. You can look at the United States and their terrible housing situation.
Mm.
It was 1995 when I first came up in the subway in San Francisco and stepped over the living bodies of hundreds of people who were homeless on the streets. I'd never seen it before in my life. Mostly black. The right to bear arms in the US is the right to bear arms to control your former slaves. So when you're looking at the terrible housing problems in the US, one in 13 black women in Baltimore evicted a year, people sleeping in their cars. It's partly the legacy of the US. And our problems are largely our legacy. 95% of Devon is still owned by the families that William was friends with in 1066 and gave them the land. You know, it's pretty unique. The rest of Europe has seen the tanks go back and forth over it within the lifetimes of grandparents, which creates you a different idea about the permeability and endurance of housing, and also what matters most. It's not simply our inability that has got us into this particular situation. But you can go back and look at previous empires. The richest place before England in the world was the United Provinces in what's now the Netherlands. And they've sorted themselves out now, despite all their arrogance, you know, a long time ago. But the Swedish Empire wasn't great, and they've sorted themselves out now. But we are, in a way, the last empire that's still not kicked the habit and the arrogance. And when we do it, that'll leave the Americans as the next people to deal with their problem. But yes, I agree. That's partly there. The other thing to say about Finland on this is, if they didn't do it, people would just leave. They had mass emigration to Canada and the United States and Germany, and they just left. And one thing that Finland does better than the other Nordic countries is it spends more money on the bottom quarter of children, on their education, than any others. And it partly does it because it's you get better returns. But also, the bottom quarter are most likely to leave somewhere where life can be a bit hard at times and so on. Now, because of being having the empire and then the Commonwealth, we have not had a problem getting people to come here. We have people coming from East Africa that were not even our colonies, just because of the reputation of England and Manchester United. When you ask people, why did you miss trekking across the Sahel and Sahara? Whereas Finland, for a time, nobody was going to go to Finland. If you didn't look after the population, they wouldn't stay. And we have almost the opposite. Our ruling elite doesn't see the rest of the people as them. It's the lower orders. Little people have a mortgage, which shows how little they understand, because to have a mortgage nowadays, you've got to be really well off. But you've got to remember, our ruling elite buy property in cash. They don't borrow. And that has made it harder. But series of crises, the banking crisis of 2008, the longest, deepest recession on record since then, a pandemic which we haven't had since 1968, and that one we just let run through. We are in the biggest crisis since coming out of a war. And the idea that something fundamentally doesn't change now, it is almost impossible to imagine. But you're left with the worry. This is why it's worth doing the meetings. Something fundamentally is going to change now in this country. Doesn't guarantee it fundamentally changes for the better, but it's going to fundamentally change. And it's there for the winning. And it's even in the interest of those. I get to meet people who own three or four houses. They're not actually very happy. So the irony of all this is, you know, it's not as if the people who own flats in One High Park are beside themselves with glee. It's a ridiculous situation we've got ourselves in. And what's happening and it's worth just ending talking about the elite rather than people on the streets and so on, is that they're forcing their children to go into particular occupations if they haven't got 20 million wealth, so they've only got two, that all, where they can earn enough money, so it can only be lawyers, business, and a few other things, so that they can afford to buy the same really expensive house that they grew up in and pay for the same school that they went to, because their fear of being normal is so absolutely enormous. And they've got themselves into this situation which makes it very hard to sell logically to a population. And hence they're forced to do whatever they can to hold up house prices. So my prediction for you, I can tell you if I'm wrong, if we see house prices begin to fall over Christmas and it look dodgy, Sunak, the Chancellor, will come out with Help to Buy Free. Discounts of 50% on buying your flat in Dalston Junction, they will do whatever it takes. They will borrow as much money as they can from the world markets to try and keep things going as they are. And at that point, Labour needs to be able to say there is a better, another way of doing this, as they borrow an absolute fortune trying to ensure that the south of England remains the most expensive place in Europe, despite the fact that people are trying to leave it, not actually come into it.
Danny, that is absolutely fascinating, and I think we're all going to want to find out a huge amount more about Finland. We've got a prediction, and we've got for Christmas, which is a good thing, and we've got a reminder about why we all go to local Labour Party meetings, which some of us might not need a reminder, but some of us might. So we're really grateful to have you, Danny. I just feel it really thoughtful from you, and lots of things to think about, and you're welcome any time to come and talk to us. Thank you very much.
Thanks ever so much. Bye, everybody.